and welcome to Lakeshore Updates. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on plans to vaccinate thousands of people a day at a Gary mass vaccination site. Republican lawmakers want to require an extra check of a voter's identification on absentee ballot applications. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Valparaiso City and Planning Transit Director Beth Schrader. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. A new mass vaccination center is open in Northwest Indiana just as new COVID-19 cases begin to climb. For the next 2 months, anyone 16 and older, even those from out of state or undocumented, can get vaccinated at the drive-thru center. Officials said they plan to vaccinate 2,000 people a day during the 8-week clinic and another 1,000 a day through mobile clinics that will go out into communities, including Gary, East Chicago, and Hammond, to bring the vaccinations to the people where they live, including public housing and homeless shelters. Governor Eric Holcomb, U.S. Representative Frank Mervan, Gary Deputy Mayor Trent McCain, State Senator Eddie Melton, Indiana Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Box, along with other dignitaries, visited the Gary site. Tuesday's opening at Gary's former Roosevelt High School came on the first day of Indiana's mask mandate being lifted. Governor Holcomb adds the mask mandate was lifted without political pressure.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Dunes National Park is looking for volunteers for its first ever Indiana Dunes Trash Truckers Earth Day cleanup. Registration is now open for this year's cleanup, which is being held on Thursday, April 22nd from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Supervisory Park Ranger and Public Information Officer Bruce Rowe told Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson about the event and how to get involved.
Anybody who wants to get outside on April 22nd from 9 a.m. to about noon and clean up the park, the trails, the roads, even the Little Calumet River we're going to do some cleaning of, is welcome to join.
Rose says there are some intrinsic rewards in volunteering.
I think it's a way to make your park area and Northwest Indiana in general a little bit cleaner. Take some pride in having a national park here and helping to make it as clean as we can.
To be assigned a cleanup location, register with the park's volunteer office before Sunday, April 18th. Go to parkconnection@gmail.com or call 219-221-7098. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit that represents the latest attempt by property owners in a Northwest Indiana town to deny the public access to Lake Michigan beaches. The judge found that there was no basis for three landowners in the town of Porter to sue in federal court seeking to undo a landmark 2018 Indiana Supreme Court ruling. That ruling clarified that the shoreline of Lake Michigan is owned by the state and held in trust for the enjoyment of all Hoosiers. The Times reports Attorney General Todd Rokita says he's pleased the judge granted the state's motion to dismiss the federal suit.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The COVID-19 pandemic has prompted Indiana Republican lawmakers to change the way local health officials are allowed to do their jobs during a public emergency. Right now, local health officials can impose restrictions that go further than any state orders, like counties keeping mask-wearing mandates in place after the statewide mandate has ended. A bill approved by the House Tuesday would ban that. Instead, stricter regulations could only be passed by local elected leaders county commissioners, or city councils. But Democratic Representative Rita Fleming raised the example of the rubella pandemic in the 1960s. Fleming, a retired physician, says most people, including county commissioners, would not see widespread issues with that virus. But she says health officials knew it was devastating to unborn children. And it's health officials, she says, should be making the decisions.
I think it's more important to save babies than bar owners. I think this is very dangerous.
But Republican Representative Matt Lehman says he trusts local elected officials.
They make those decisions every day now, where to put a stop sign and where to do, I mean, they deal with public safety now.
The bill passed along party lines and now heads back to the Senate.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Religious organizations would be shielded from many health orders in future public emergencies under legislation approved by the House Tuesday. Governor Eric Holcomb barred in-person worship services early in the pandemic, and other religious activities, a church-run daycare or food pantry, for instance, were restricted more than other essential services. Republican Representative Bob Morris supports legislation that would make sure that does not happen again.
It bothers me, the path that we've gone over the past year, that people could not worship and were threatened with arrest in gathering during this pandemic.
But Democratic Representative Ed Delaney worries the bill protects institutions more than people.
The people who are going to those churches are not being given the protection that the same person would be if they tried to go into any other gathering.
The bill is headed back to the Senate.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Republican lawmakers want to require an extra check of a voter's identification on absentee ballot applications. Supporters say it's about election security. Opponents argue it will unfairly cost some Hoosiers their vote. Under proposed legislation, Hoosier voters would have to include either their driver's license number or the last four digits of their Social Security number when they apply for an absentee ballot. Whichever number they choose must match whichever number is on their voter registration record. That's on top of matching signature requirements already in state law. Attorney General Todd Rokita says it's a basic regulation that helps ensure election integrity.
When people see that those things aren't being done or that folks are arguing against doing that minimal thing, they don't have confidence in the process, and then they don't participate, and that's how we lose the republic.
A House committee will likely vote on the bill later this week.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
More than half of all farm workers hired in the U.S. are from Mexico, and right now, many are making their way to farms across the country on temporary work visas. Some states are prioritizing these workers in their vaccine rollout plans and are already getting shots into their arms. As Dana Cronin reports for Side Effects Public Media, for many farm workers, at this point, vaccines are far more accessible here than in their home countries.
White vans carrying small groups of farm workers drive up periodically to the parish hall at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Cobden, Illinois, dropping off groups of men who have recently arrived from Mexico. Many of them will be here until October on temporary agricultural work visas. And on only their third day here, they're getting vaccinated. 34-year-old Jorge Feria just arrived from Oaxaca, Mexico. Moments after receiving his shot, he felt relieved.
We have the fortune to come work through a visa and have a government that cares about the people that come to work in the fields. We are very grateful.
He says if he had stayed in Mexico, he wouldn't be vaccinated. In fact, he doesn't know anyone in Mexico who has yet gotten the shot. It's a big deal for many of these workers. Farm workers have been hit particularly hard by the pandemic. According to researchers at Purdue University, in the U.S. alone, it's estimated that hundreds of thousands of agricultural workers have tested positive for the virus, and thousands have died.
Relax your arm.
Jose Martinez rolls up the sleeve of his blue tie-dye t-shirt in preparation for the shot. Martinez, who's originally from Mexico, now lives in Illinois year-round, working as a forklift operator at a farm. He says most of his family also works on farms, and almost all are vaccinated. His parents, though, remain in Mexico.
Todavía no.
They're not vaccinated yet, because in Mexico, it's really hard to get.
Carlos Leonardo Magis Rodriguez teaches medicine at the National Autonomous University of Mexico.
The real problem is that we don't have enough vaccines.
He says the supply issues mean that most Mexican residents, even healthcare workers, aren't yet vaccinated. Mexico's vaccine distribution plan is age-based, and Magis Rodriguez says he expects 20 to 30-year-olds won't become eligible until maybe next January, meaning many of the farm workers getting their shots in the U.S. now will likely be nearly a full year ahead of their peers back home. Some farm workers say many of their friends and family members are afraid to get vaccinated after hearing false information and conspiracy theories.
El gobierno está en contra de la gente.
That the government is against the people and that they're putting the virus in our bodies.
Eleazar Chavez also recently arrived from Oaxaca on a work visa. The night before getting vaccinated, he attended an informational session put on by a local health clinic. Carla Gravler ran that Q&A session. She says many workers come in both concerned and unprepared for the vaccine, and it's important to dispel myths right away with accurate information about vaccines.
You know, how they work in the body, what kinds of vaccines we have in the market, what kind of vaccines do we want to receive today, and then what to expect after receiving the vaccine. So they know, they can identify, okay, I have fever, I have chills, okay, well, don't get alarmed. My body is responding to the vaccine.
After some initial hesitation, Grathler says all 22 of the most recently arrived farm workers got their vaccine shots. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Dana Cronin.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here is regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Beth Schrader.
The city of Valparaiso, the officials and staff would like to know more about the housing market in the city for the benefit of all of the residents. And they in turn have commissioned a very important study. And in turn, let's find out more about the results of that study. We have with us Beth Schrader, who is the Valparaiso City Planning and Transit Director. And Beth, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, first, if you will tell us a little bit about the organization that has crunched all the data and where all the data came from. What did Urban Partners have to do to be able to come up with the study that you now have in your hands?
Well, Urban Partners is based out of Philadelphia. They're a small planning organization who specializes in doing these types of studies. Mm-hmm. So what they did for us is take a lot of the publicly available data. It's from Department of Housing and Urban Development, from Census, from American Community Survey, and then they're able to kind of crunch the numbers in a way that gives a snapshot of our housing market.
What were you and Mayor Murphy and other staffers at City Hall hoping to be able to put together from all of this data that's out there? A lot of it's out there. What were you hoping that you would receive, and in turn, some of the interesting findings that are in the study that the folks at Urban Partners have put together?
We're hoping to just get a better handle on how we were doing as a community in terms of providing the type of housing, and it was best serving Valparaiso, and it was fulfilling our mission and our comprehensive plan. And so it was important to have kind of the baseline data. The last time that any of this was pulled, and it wasn't pulled in such a comprehensive way, was probably our comprehensive plan, which was adopted in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So this serves as an update, and we get a kind of a benchmark or a starting point going forward to see how we're doing. So I guess a number of the findings, some are surprising, some weren't necessarily. So there's a lot about Valparaiso that follows national trends. So on one level, that isn't terribly surprising that we are, like the rest of the nation, going to feel the effects of the silver tsunami, as our consultants like to call it. So,
oh, really?
The nation is aging, and the population of Valparaiso is aging too. So we have a large sector of our population that is moving into a phase of their life where they're looking for less maintenance, possibly smaller living quarters. They're looking, though, for amenities and walkability too. So trying to provide housing types that satisfy those needs is important. And the great thing about that is those qualities are also attractive to other age groups, especially those who are just starting out. So that was a good finding that came out of this, and I think provides us some direction of what we want to see. We also learned that in terms of our housing stock, we have kind of an aging housing stock. And that is not just something that we need to keep on top of, make sure that we're making investments into our existing housing stock so that we don't see any slippage of the quality and the property values. So that was an important finding. We also learned that we're facing affordability challenges, uh-huh, similar to the rest of the nation. So this is something that we did a pretty deep dive on, and we found that, you know, in terms of the county, the city of Valparaiso is kind of over-providing on some levels, but at the same time, we still have an affordability gap for many individuals that are in Valparaiso. So there's a lot of the strategies that came out of the data address multiple of these key findings at once. So there was a encouragement of density and really capitalizing on the success of our downtown. That's kind of where we're seeing a lot of market pressure, but and we want to kind of allow that to happen. So we need to kind of assess the zoning around our downtown, our parking minimums, things that may be a stumbling block for developing that higher density around our downtown. And allowing that, making it easier, kind of helps address a number of things. So it helps with affordability. It helps with providing the type of housing that is that we need the most. More dense, walkable, access to amenities, low maintenance, and can also be affordable. So I think that was a big takeaway for us. And so our next steps are to really dive into the what types of changes we need to make to our code in order to allow that density to happen. So
You got a lot to work on, to be sure. It's a lots come up in the last 7 years. Did in going through all of this with Urban Partners, did you find any real surprising things that go back 7 years that were not necessarily the case then, but they are now?
Well, the look back period is, depending on the data set, Urban Partners had data from 2010, which was, of course, the last census.
Yeah.
Some of the other data sets update at different intervals. So we're looking at 2016 for some of the HUD data. So there's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison between the data that was collected in 2013 as part of the master plan. I'd say that there's I don't say that there was any huge surprises in the data based on what we knew in 2013, but I think that just having a more complete picture, and there was lots of interesting, even data points that seemed contradictory, but together they provide a more complete picture of our housing market.
I see. What kind of role does Valparaiso University play in putting the data together and certainly what was found the consultant came across when they put their report out to the city of Valparaiso?
Yeah, well, I think that, we're part of what makes Valparaiso Valparaiso is being a university town. So VU is very important to the community and to Valparaiso City. And I think it affects the development of our housing and the patterns that we see. So we're a lot more similar in our rates of rental housing to other university cities than we are to peer communities in the region. So we have a higher percentage of rentals in Valparaiso than you would see in, Crown Point or LaPorte, Portage, some of the other places around here. And so that is still the case. We do know that there's some decrease in enrollment at the university, and it's a little early to see all the effects of that in the data because of the dates that it was collected. But we seem to see a softening, especially around the university in terms of the rental demand, even though 60% of the students are living off campus.
Oh.
At least the data that was collected still showed that. So I think that's going to be definitely a data set that we'll want to track and update going into the future to make sure that we're making decisions with all the right information.
Now, it looks like, based on what you've mentioned so far, Beth, that there's going to be a very serious study about the housing areas that are around immediate downtown Valparaiso. Are we seeing that there are more people that want to live closer to downtown? They may have jobs outside of Porter County, but they want to live close to downtown because they like all the amenities that they get to have.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in particular that the consultants mentioned that they liked or mentioned about downtown that the city should know about to be able to better prepare for making changes that'll mean more housing and better housing for around downtown?
Well, I think the challenges that are specific to Valparaiso with increased density is just the way that a development would move through the process with the city. Do they have to get variances or try to change their zone in order to build the denser type of structures? We need to look at that and try to make it so that there's not extra steps in the process to build the type of denser housing that is appropriate around the downtown. But in order to do that, we have to have a good idea about the impact that will have on the neighborhoods. And in terms of, demand on services, but also parking, that's always a big one that comes up. And so we need to update our parking analysis. So the last time that was done is 2010, and we have seen growth in the downtown since then. And
right.
And new developments come in, denser developments near downtown. So we want to look at the parking counts, see if there's any room to, reduce those to make the density easier to build kind of by right without many extra steps mm-hmm. in the process.
It sounds like that the Valparaiso City Council and other city departments, including yours, are going to have a lot of work ahead. Some of the city council members have had a chance to take a look at some of the early data, have something to say about it?
Absolutely. So we provided that to them, I think, before it went out to the public. And we had, I think, all of our city council members join the presentation, the question and answer session that we had last Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some really good questions. And rightly so, they're all very interested in, okay, what are the next steps? What do we take from this data? How do we implement these strategies? And a lot of that will fall to my plate, but all of it will kind of starts with my department, will go through the plan commission, and then it comes to city council. So there'll be a lot of time for consideration and really deliberating on these, you know, important issues, make sure that we get it right.
Well, it sounds like, too, that the citizens of Valparaiso, once they get a chance to take a look at it, they'll be able to ask questions and in turn keep you all busy trying to answer their questions, too.
Yes, well, that's what we're here for. So I encourage everyone to, you know, call the planning department with your questions or send me an email, and I'll be happy to walk you through it and answer any questions that you have.
Well, Beth, thank you for spending time going through the information that you have from this very, very comprehensive residential market analysis. The study that the consultants had put together for you and other members of city administration and the public in Valparaiso to take a look at. And we're all looking forward to more discussions in the near future about this and trying to find ways to make housing better in Valparaiso. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Beth Schrader is the Valparaiso City Planning and Transit Director, talking about the new residential market analysis that's just come out, and you can take a look at it on
Regionally
the
Speaking
Valparaiso
with
website.
Host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.